Mike Igo, most people remember you for your work in local television news, but you have spent 3 years teaching full-time in China.
Yeah, after 30 years in the media, I decided I was going to be a scholarly professor. And the way I fell into it was kind of crazy. When I was in the media, I always wanted to do a story about Made in China, how everything in our life comes from China. Well, that never happened. I got to go to Ireland and trace my roots, so I just never made it to China. Well, lo and behold, after I left the media, I was working as a full-time adjunct at Buffalo State, and one of my colleagues showed me an ad for the college in China I ultimately worked at, and she said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Yeah, why not?" Well, I applied, and next thing I knew, I had a job interview, and next thing I knew, I had a job offer. And I said, "Well, this is all well and good, but going and doing a story for a couple weeks is one thing. Living there for a year or two is another, but, you know," I said, "why not?" My kids were grown. I couldn't have done it 10 years before, and I said, if I don't at least try this, I'm always going to wonder what if for the rest of my life when I'm sitting in the rocking chair, I wonder what China would have been like. So I gave it a shot, and fortunately, it worked out very well. But having said that, when I first got over there, boy, oh boy, what a cultural experience.
Yeah, you're not exactly talking about just moving from one town to another. You're talking about an entire cultural shift.
Yeah, for sure. Now, when you go to China, if you go to a big major city like Shanghai or Beijing, lots of English all over the place. Zhuhai, the place I went to, nobody's talking English. In fact, when I got taken from the port to my hotel, the driver who spoke English said to me, "Professor Mike, you know, you're on your own now. No one in this hotel is going to talk English. Anything you need?" I said, nah, I'll be fine. Well, lo and behold, I get in the hotel room. It's not fine. I had some tummy trouble, and the room is out of toilet paper. And I said, oh, boy, what do we do about this? Do we do charades? How do we communicate with people who can't talk English? Well, lo and behold, I remembered my daughter had gave me a little pocket translator that had stock phrases in it. You punch in a certain code, look in a book, and then it plays phrases. So I look in the book, and lo and behold, the phrase I need was in there. The room is out of toilet paper. I go down to the front desk. I punch in the code. It plays in Chinese. The room is out of toilet paper. They laugh hysterically and give me the darn toilet paper. And that was the beginning of it. But that's the main thing there. You learn, you really appreciate when people come to our country who don't speak English what they go through. Because in Zhuhai, again, there's not a lot of English. My college was English speaking, but first couple of days I'm by myself figuring things out. Anything I could do with body language, my little pocket translator, which was fine, but the pocket translator didn't have expressions for everything. So I was pretty much on my own, but fortunately, we got through it.
Well, language is just one of the barriers you have to overcome. There's also, you need to be careful with what you say. It is a communist state, so some of the freedoms we take for granted over here, you do not have in China, and if you're not too careful, you can find that out the hard way.
Absolutely right. One of the things you don't talk about, in fact, they have a list of forbidden topics, and one of them is the First Amendment, which was one of the things which was supposed to be part of my media law course. And there are topics that are very, very sensitive. Religion's also an issue. Religion cannot be out in the open. And you kind of learn by doing the things we take for granted. That's why when I teach my law students here at SUNY Fredonia, I tell them how fortunate they are. The things they take for granted are a non-issue there. There is no Facebook. There's a lot of internet blocking. There's no YouTube. There's a lot of things you can't get at. The social media that our kids use every single day, time in and time out, the students over there usually can't get it. I say usually because many of them have the VPNs, which unlocks the media. It's kind of a little game the young people play with the censors. There's a very sophisticated censorship system where the government blocks a lot of things, and ironically, the technology is developed in the United States that they use. And it's a little game. The kids who are very good and very tech savvy figure out how to get against its censor, and then the censor figures out how to get in. They kind of piggyback. In fact, I had a VPN myself to be able to get in on the internet sites that I wanted. And I think during my 3 years there, I think I did about 20 or 25 updates to stay at the latest technologies. So very, very different climate.
Having said that, how well-versed are young Chinese citizens and students to what's going on in the rest of the world? How informed are they?
They are. They find the ways to get the information they need. And, you know, one of the things I was very fortunate as a teacher, they were happy to have me there because they like Americans. The Chinese government may be leery of us, but the kids love us. In fact, the first week I was there, I had more students come to my office hours in 1 week than I had a whole semester when I taught at another college before I went to SUNY Fredonia. And the kids, they were, another reason they were there, my college tended to be, their families were fairly wealthy and had business interests with the U.S. So they were there to learn English, learn the cultural sensibility, learn about overseas. So they're really hip to what's what. They don't often talk about it because they know they got to be careful with what they say. But they know what's going on. And as I say, they figured out how to beat the technology, how to keep up on things. You know, another perfect example, they love American TV shows. It cracked me up when I was there. The shows that are very popular with our young people were very popular with theirs as well. things like Gossip Girl was big at the time, The Big Bang Theory, and a ton of them. What's interesting, there's a whole group of young people who volunteer and they translate the American shows on their own voluntarily into Chinese. But it's not as easy as that because there's a cultural sensibility. Sometimes things don't work. So, for example, if we might say thank God in one of our TV shows, they would change it to thank Mao and little things like that. Because with translation, it's not a very precise art. You do not want to translate literally because if you do, it might lose the whole idea. Perfect example. When KFC came overseas to China, they translated "It's finger licking good" into Chinese, and the way they translated came out to something to the effect of "eat your fingers off." So obviously you do not translate literally. You give kind of a more of a general sensibility. Same way Pepsi. Pepsi at one time had the expression "come alive, you're in the Pepsi generation." Well, that was translated wrongly and came out something like "we will make your ancestors rise up from the grave." So that didn't work out either. So you got to translate things to get the spirit of something, not literal word for word.
I had read somewhere where it was an old Jack Nicholson movie with Helen Hunt, As Good as It Gets, translated into the phrase "Mr. Cat Poop" in China. I had actually read that's how they translated the movie title. So you get some rather interesting translations, and also just some of the everyday quirks. I mean, like a show like Seinfeld that kind of explores some of the everyday quirks of people in New York City. I can't imagine that folks in Beijing would necessarily relate to that directly.
Yeah, exactly right. And that's one of my challenges in the classroom. You know, the things I would talk about on a day-to-day basis with my kids because it's part of our life may not have any meaning to them. So one of the things I used to say that when I taught there, it would take me twice as much time to prepare my material because I had to think about things that would relate to the point in the society that they were living in. And one of the things I got pretty good at, as I learned my students better, I learned what the things are that they liked. For example, one thing that really surprised me, they were big Michael Jackson fans, which was kind of amazing because they were, kids late teens, early 20s. But once I found out they loved Michael Jackson, one of the things I did is I took his Thriller video one time in my journalism class, and I used that as an example of good shooting and good editing. And they really grasped what I was talking about because they loved Michael Jackson. So that was always the challenge as a teacher, to find the things that they'd relate to. In some cases, it was American society things, but you had to just find how to make the connection. But again, things that we would take for granted in everyday life may not have any meaning or may not resonate with them.
China has also emerged as a significant economic power. Their middle class alone, I had read somewhere, is larger than the entire U.S. population. A lot of buying power over there.
Absolutely. And one of the things the Chinese are especially noted for is they are excellent savers. And, you know, there's a lot of restrictions about what they can do with their money. Banking's very restricted and whatnot. So they have found ways kind of around or within the system. For example, one of the things that's become very popular there is investing in property. I guess no big surprise there, but there's a lot more flexibility as far as that. But the Chinese are for sure excellent savers. And some of them do have a good amounts of money. But even the average person, I think, is very, very careful about their money.
And of course, with economic growth, there's a price to pay environmentally. You know, the Chinese, they love to consume their oil. They are starting to explore some green energy. But you saw it for yourself. Tell me about just how, you know, the environmental side effects of a rapidly growing economy.
Yeah, for sure. A lot of the downsides of environmental problems you would not see on the newscast because it's government controlled. But interestingly enough, when my kids went out and did news packages, they showed me some of the problems in their stories. And you think about it, in some respects, the Chinese are like what we were during the revolution, the Industrial Revolution. You know, there's a price to pay when you start, burning all this oil, putting fumes in the air and whatnot. And there are many, many communities. They did very, very well economically, but they found out after the fact there's other consequences, water pollution, air pollution, or whatnot. And now they have to deal with it. And the ironic part about it is you notice a lot of the manufacturing is going elsewhere now because to make up for the environmental problems and create and eliminate other issues, then it increased their transaction costs. So that's why some of the companies are going elsewhere. They're going to Sri Lanka. They're going to India. They're going to Thailand because now China has to take care of these problems because they can't go on because people are getting sicker with them. So very, very interesting. There are environmental issues. You won't hear much about it. Except for during the Beijing Olympics, you did hear about it because they shut down all the factories for 2 weeks because of the air pollution. But if you go online and look at some of the pictures, Beijing in the wintertime is just like Western New York. And there are many, many pictures of the cold trapping all the pollution down there and people roaming around with face masks on and everything. So very, very interesting.
when you're there for 3 years, you have the opportunity perhaps to travel and see some other parts of the country. Where else did you get to go, and what struck you the most, what pleased you the most?
Well, one of the first things I did was at the end of my first year, I rewarded myself with a trip to the Great Wall. Ever since I was a little boy in the 1960s, I had always wanted to go see the Great Wall. And actually, it turned out I went to see the Great Wall when I was almost 60. But, you know, it's just like America in some respects. You know, everybody thinks, you know, you have all these historic sites all over, and you do. But the average Chinese city, many of them do not look that much different than our cities. You know, if you roam around, were it not for the Chinese signs here, you know, you see the average high rises, the average highways. If you look closer and you see the Chinese signs, you know you're not in Kansas anymore. But I visited extensively because, fortunately, when you're not at home and you don't have to deal with the happy homeowner chores, I had time to travel. So I saw many, many, many sites, including the Terracotta Warriors, which was fantastic. I saw the Lee River, which is a wonderful landscape area. I made an effort to really travel and experience as much as I could. But China is such a huge country. To get and see these places, you know, keep in mind, you really got to travel some distance sometime.
What did you take away from your experience there that you brought here that you think other Americans should look to China for?
Well, from a teaching point of view, it really helped my teaching because I had to learn how to reach an audience that was already dealing with a language issue. English, of course, is their second language. And also, I got very good at reading students' eyes. And if I saw the deer in the headlight look, I knew I needed to restate what it had or find a different way to state it. So from a teaching point of view, that was good. But the other thing is, in some respects, my students always ask me, what's the difference between them and us? And I said, there's no real difference, basically, except for the Chinese are a little more shy. Because, you know, the main tradition of Chinese culture is you don't want to lose face. And it was a little bit of a challenge because when I first got there, they were very leery of speaking up in class. So I established something called Professor Igo's No Statues Policy. I'd show a picture of the big Buddha on Lantau Island in Hong Kong. And I said, okay, what does a statue do? And they go, nothing. I said, that's right. That's not what you're going to do. You're going to speak. If you're going to be a communicator or a journalist, and I mostly taught journalism students, I said, you have to speak for a living. If you're uncomfortable with that, you have chosen the wrong career field. It's time to make a change. And they got that. So that was my biggest challenge. But the people overall in China, they love Americans. They're very interested in America. They will engage me, and even people who did not have very good English skills would come up and talk to me. So the government may be leery of us, but the people for sure do respect America and do want to make the connection as much as they can.
What are some of the challenges teaching a Chinese journalism student? We spoke earlier about some of the challenges you don't necessarily get to speak as freely. How many obstacles are there in trying to gather information in a controlled society as that?
They are amazed at how free we are. You know, despite what you want to say about America and all the criticism we come under, our First Amendment does mean something. China has something that's equivalent to the First Amendment, but it's a joke. It doesn't mean anything at all. It's called, it's called something like the First Amendment, but it's not. So our students are amazed. In fact, they were amazed at the foreign teachers, how free we are about speaking about things. You know, that we basically say what's on our mind. We cut right to the chase. We used to have an expression in China with my colleagues. We called it circling the wagon. Sometimes they're very careful about what they're saying, and you got to figure out, okay, what are you trying to tell me here without telling me that? So we cut right to the chase. But, you know, overall, I have to say my experiences were generally quite positive. And I have been back after my 3 years of teaching there. I've been back a couple times. I did a Fulbright for a couple weeks a few years ago in Hong Kong. And this past spring, I was in a place called Shenzhen, which is right across the border from Hong Kong. So one of the things that struck me, there were some changes in some ways that had changed a lot. For example, their version of Uber has arrived there. When I lived there, they had illegal cars, which they weren't supposed to be going, but they were. And now it's a whole formalized system, just like what our Uber would be. But for sure, I think the Chinese students are having an impact on the future. No big surprise there, except for little by little, some of the cultural restraints are vanishing. Perfect example. One of the things the Chinese government is very concerned about now is Christianity is really taking hold in China, especially among the wealthy. And I'm not so sure why that is. It has a certain attraction. And in fact, they had a campaign at one time that they were actually going around and they were taking down crosses under the guise of zoning violations. You know, this was unsafe and that was foolishness. But one of my favorite stories in one community in China, which was mostly old people, they surrounded their church like a human chain so the soldiers wouldn't get through. And they didn't plow through them. They remembered Tiananmen Square very quickly. And I think they didn't want another PR disaster like that. But religion is becoming more of an issue, especially Christianity, because that was primarily a Buddhist society for many, many years. So Christianity is taking root for whatever reason.
You know, religion was at the roots of many Poles, for example, during, you know, the Solidarity Movement and what seemed to be the beginning of the end of the Iron Curtain of the old Soviet Empire. Do you see the potential there for, you know, the Chinese communism to eventually crumble?
I think so. I think it would be a longer and slower process because the Chinese are very calculated, a lot more careful compared to many other societies. But I think China is going to have to change because, you know, the challenge, as they always talk about, they want to be the number one economic power. In theory, they could be, but they have a lot of things about their system. You know, I can't even get into all the details, but I'll give you one example. When I first went there to wire money home, the process took me almost 2 hours to do it. Now, here, that's like a 5 or 10 minute transaction. And there's a lot of things that the government has done to maintain control, but unfortunately, it doesn't help them in the economic picture. And little by little, the things are changing. And as I say, as the young people take hold, get more positions of power, positions of influence, they will change some of these things because they have to and because it behooves them. You know, same situation with the people who made money at China. The people who really capitalized early on with the relationship with America are the people who learned how to work with the system or work around the system. There are these government officials called cadres, who are the local guys, basically, and women too, in communities who know how to get things done, how to acquire land, what permits to get and whatnot. And they are the ones who not only enriched their own pocketbooks, but also have helped others, you know, big corporations like Walmart, among many others, how to do business in China. So for sure, Chinese society will change. There's a possibility communism will crumble or maybe take a different form. But do remember, this has been entrenched for a long, long time. The Chinese communists took over in 1949. And China, I think more so than even other countries, it is a lot more deliberate. It would be much slower to change compared to, say, East and West Germany and so on.
Mike Igoe, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.